We're talking about the latest in national politics, from relationships with other countries on full display at the G7 earlier this week, to domestic policy and the shaping of the 2020 campaign. We just have no shortage of topics for conversation. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. What questions do you have about the latest immigration moves by the Trump administration? What's your opinion on moving funds away from disaster relief to support enforcement at the U.S. border? 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He's also a faculty advisor to the College Republicans there. Tim, welcome back to The Morning Show.
Morning.
Good morning, and thank you for being with us. We know that the Washington Post is reporting that President Trump wants to complete his border wall before the 2020 election takes place, and we understand that there are some moves to try to fast-track construction using eminent domain or trying to avoid environmental regulations. Tim, how critical is this for President Trump in an election season?
Well, probably fairly critical. I wouldn't say it's a do or die kind of thing for him in terms of satisfying one of his major promises that he made as a candidate, but it's certainly something that he needs to show that he's doing something in terms of making progress, just to be at least be able to say, look, you know, we're working on it. It may not be completed yet, but we're getting there kind of a thing. Of course, as we've also seen, that he'll blame Democrats for obstructing it, which he's done and will continue to do, but certainly he needs to make some progress. And aside from even Democrats maybe wanting, not maybe, but wanting to obstruct progress on the wall, that's one of their big issues too, is that you do have things like you mentioned, eminent domain. So, of course, people that own the land along the where the wall is intended to be built, they need to be paid. You can't just take their land, and so they may be resisting too. And so that's kind of a bureaucratic thing that's just business as usual, and so you have to find ways around that as well.
You know, some argue that the president was joking. We have reports, though, that he told aides that he'll pardon people if they break the law when they are trying to make this happen. How should we interpret that statement from the leader of the country?
Well, it sounds like it's another one of these things where Trump kind of comes up with these phrases and sort of saying, throwing things out there that maybe he's not particularly serious about or hasn't really thought through in ways that were used to presidents and other government leaders saying, okay, let's think this through before we make a statement, because they often know that if they make statements that seem, you know, really over the top or ridiculous or whatever, that they'll get a lot of blowback on it. Well, Trump doesn't care about that, that he'll kind of throw out these things, get people excited, and that's sort of part of his method of operation, that he basically gets people excited, gets people worked up talking about it, and he says, oh, you know, that's not really going to do that, or we're going to do something a little bit different, or, you know, why are you complaining about this? You should have been complaining about it. So it just kind of generates conversation, to put it politely.
U.S. Representative David Cicilline is a Democratic leader, and he suggested that if this is going on, this might be warranting an investigation by the House Judiciary Committee. So, I mean, is the president playing with fire and creating a real political issue, you know, especially as Democrats have the House?
Well, to a certain extent, if the president took any steps along something that might be considered inappropriate, if not illegal, then certainly people would want to be concerned. But again, you have to be careful about the president just throwing out some of these things like he ordinarily does. Now, the flip side of that, of course, is, again, we're not used to the president's doing that kind of a thing. And so it can rub people the wrong way, again, to kind of minimize that. And if the House wants to, because it's in the hands of the Democrats to investigate, they're going to investigate. The problem for them is that they're investigating so many things at this point that it's taking up a lot of their time, and it can potentially hurt them a year from now when we're in election season for 2020 if they don't have or haven't shown any progress in terms of passing bills or getting things through. And certainly for the Democrats, they say, well, look, all we can do is pass at the House. It's going to stall in the Senate. Well, okay, then, you know, you need to work with the Senate and find something that you can work on a bipartisan basis to get certain things done. It can't all be obstruction, 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 even if you don't like President Trump. And so, and that works both ways, that both parties sort of have that problem where they need to show that they're at least trying in one way or another.
Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. I'm Keely Boltina. In a few moments, we'll talk about the trade war with China. We're wondering how tariffs are affecting your business. Are you out of work or making less money because of the trade war? What do you think the right strategy is for the U.S.? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 to talk about that and other issues of national politics. Tim, I want to stick with the border wall. We know that the Trump administration is using hundreds of millions of dollars set aside for disaster relief for border enforcement. And, you know, that's right as Tropical Storm Dorian might be turning into a hurricane in the southeastern United States. So is this the right move at the right time?
Well, in terms of whether it's the right move, I kind of split that question up. It's something that I saw pointed out where the Obama administration did something basically the same, that something along the lines of $400 million was reprogrammed. And it's a matter of what you're using that money for. And again, administrations do this all the time, that they are, of course, bound by whatever amount, whatever money that they're allowed to spend based on congressional authorizations, but they can sometimes, as the phrase is, reprogram it, saying, well, it's going to go for this, but now we're going to use it for this other kind of thing. And they've got it from the administration's point of view, and other people recognize this too, there's a crisis on the border, and if they're going to use that money, if not for disaster relief, then to deal with this other crisis situation, then that seems understandable, aside from, you know, being opposed to whatever it is that the Trump administration is doing. On the other hand, and then we get to the second part of that question, which is the timing of it does look kind of bad when you have a storm out there that's becoming a hurricane. Maybe Puerto Rico seems to have been spared primarily, but it's now heading towards Florida. We don't know quite where the models are going to show that it's going to go. But there's a great potential that, you know, you could have a very disastrous situation in Florida, and now all of a sudden some of this money has been used elsewhere. On the other hand, if you do have a situation where there's a terrible disaster and a lot of money is needed in the Federal Disaster Relief Fund, I'm sure Congress would be willing to appropriate more money for that purpose. But it does look bad, and it gives, again, the Democrats an opportunity to criticize not just the move, but, as you indicate, the timing of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Congress, and one of the reasons Immigration and Customs Enforcement said it needed to transfer the funds is that Congress didn't appropriate enough money for detention beds and other operations at the border. So if we move the money now and then Congress passes federal disaster relief, it's hard to figure out whose responsibility this is.
Right.
It's not just me, Tim.
That's part of the problem, and to some extent, it's even part of the game, so to speak, that people are playing, is that you want to, that certainly Democrats don't want to give Trump a win, and they, you know, want to make, to a certain extent, maybe want to find ways to criticize him. If all of a sudden they put a lot of money into solving the housing and separation issues and all these other things at the border, then that makes that situation less dire, and so then they have something less to complain about. Now, that's a pretty cynical way of looking at it, but it does seem that that's what's happening when you see Congress, particularly the Democrats in the House, don't seem willing to then appropriate enough money to solve this particular crisis. But on the other hand, they're going to say, oh, but this was caused by Trump's policies, doing these sorts of things, and he caused this, and it's not our fault. And so everybody's pointing the finger someplace else. And I think the general public at some point just gets fed up with the whole thing.
Yeah.
And that's why you see a lot of people getting turned off by politics.
That makes sense. Political scientist Tim Hagel stays with us. Next up, we're talking about the Chinese tariffs, the United States senator saying Russia is denying their visas. What's your take on these situations? 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Two months from now, children born overseas to some American military members or federal workers may not have automatic U.S. citizenship. We learned yesterday that parents will have to apply for citizenship for kids before they turn 18. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about developments in politics this week, and we're taking your calls. Were you born while your parents served in another country? What do you think of this new policy? 800-642-1234. We're also wondering how you think the U.S. should position itself with Russia. Do you see tensions ratcheting up, or is this business as usual? Email us at ideas@wpr.org. The University of Iowa's Tim Hagel is offering information and analysis. He's Associate Professor of Political Science. Tim, that new federal policy issued Wednesday says some children born to parents in the military overseas can't claim automatic citizenship. What's going on with this policy? Who does it apply to?
You know, that's a good question. When I saw that, I went ahead and took a look at the policy advice that was issued by the relevant government agency. I forget the acronym for it. But it and then looked at the statute. I looked that up, too, and trying to sort this out, saying, well, how does this actually apply? And, of course, you saw some people come out immediately and say, oh, this is terrible. It does all those things, especially in terms of, you know, people that are in the armed services and that are stationed overseas and have children. And then somebody else came back and said, well, no, wait a minute. Only it applies if you adopt a child while you're stationed overseas, either as armed forces or as, you know, part of a diplomatic mission or something like that. And so, and that's a big difference in terms of what's going on that in terms of how that law applies. And so I'm not really an expert in immigration law. So I think that we need to maybe wait and see how much it actually applies and who it applies to. In part, the rationale, according to the document, the policy advice was that it was to try to make things more consistent, that apparently part of the problem was that, you know, depending on which government form you used, you had to do this thing. If you used a different form, you had to do it a little bit differently in order to make sure to verify the citizenship, that in some sense it was still automatic, but you had to verify it given that the child was born outside the United States. So it may be more of just a bureaucratic thing that just kind of sounds bad but really isn't. We'll kind of have to wait and see.
And it also seems to apply to parents living in the U.S. for fewer than 5 years before they're overseas. This has been kind of piecemealed out. I feel like we don't have a full grasp of what's going on with a policy that apparently takes effect at the end of October. What should we watch for when we're trying to figure out what the details really are?
Right. And you mentioned the residency thing. That's part of it, that you need to have resided in the United States for 5 years. And then there are some different things because you can kind of leave and come back and that sort of thing to establish your citizenship. So you can be a citizen of the United States and never actually having lived here. But then the idea is that to pass that citizenship on down to your kids, that's where you need to have established that residency, either on your part or the part of that child. Again, this takes place sometime in October, at the end of October. And so I don't expect that we'll see huge changes. It's more this kind of thing where you say, oh my goodness, you know, the children of people that are stationed overseas, armed forces in particular, how could we do this to kind of thing? So it's that kind of a thing where you can take a policy that's maybe pretty vague, not really sure how it applies, and it sounds really bad. So it's another way to attack the administration. Whereas if you look at it and say, well, wait a minute, how many people does this actually apply to? What's the purpose of it? Is it really just to try to untangle some of the red tape and make it clear as far as what's going on? Does it really make any significant change? It didn't seem to, but again, to a certain extent, we just kind of have to wait and see. If all of a sudden it's applying to a huge number of people and it's a big hassle to do so, okay, now maybe Congress needs to get involved again and clarify the statute. And if it's just, again, sort of a thing, sorting things out, one less form, hopefully fairly simple, then it's not going to be a big deal.
Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about the latest in national politics. That includes the 2020 race for president. When do you want to see Democratic hopefuls get out of the race? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. First, let's talk China. Troy in Muskego has something to say this morning. Troy, welcome to the morning show.
Yes, I just want to say that this whole tariff thing is a complete scam. I grew up, anybody grew up in the 80s knows that It was just a way for Donald Trump to get a lot of votes from blue-collar workers. Everybody knows in the 80s that NAFTA was, one of the reasons that it was blamed for a lot of people losing their jobs. And what ended up happening was there was this big talk about, oh, it's because of tariffs. And here's the irony of it. Most of those people are retired. that worked blue-collar jobs in the 80s, and it was a way of getting their votes. And I do want to say that I think what's going to come out of the tariffs is absolutely nothing for workers. What's going to end up, we got a tax rate. We haven't seen wages have not going up anywhere near where they need to be. And those jobs ain't coming back. So that's all I want to say.
Troy, thanks for the call. Tim, he's got this take on this kind of ratcheting up of these, you know, trade considerations between the U.S. and China right now. What's going on with the back and forth?
Well, to a certain extent, it has to do with, as the caller indicated, that it has to do with the job situation. He was talking more about NAFTA and, you know, where Trump is, of course, trying to negotiate a new deal with Canada and Mexico over that, and that's something that's sort of waiting to have some action taken in Congress. But as far as the China trade situation, it's a matter of not just the jobs situation, but also in terms of things like stealing our intellectual property and other sorts of things. And that's part of what Trump's trying to deal with. And, you know, to a certain extent, people understand that, but it does cause a certain pain. And that's one of the things and phrases that you hear often a lot is short-term pain for long-term gain. And so people are often willing to deal with a certain amount of problems, whether it's slightly increased prices for some goods that maybe we could get cheaper from China and so forth over the short term, in terms of long term getting a better deal with China in terms of them behaving, so to speak, in terms of not stealing our intellectual property and not dumping products and what have you.
You know,
we'll have to, again, wait and see if that's going to be successful. But at a certain point, when that short-term pain becomes a little bit more long-term, that's when people start to get a little more antsy about it and are not happy if their products are not being sold, something, of course, that a lot of Midwestern agricultural states are very concerned about.
Yeah. With that rationale and the economics of it, what's your take on the strategy? We have conflicting reports about whether the president regrets ratcheting up the trade war or actually wishes he would have, you know, increased tariffs more. The strategy is kind of it seems to be full of conflict.
Well, that's just so unusual for this administration, right?
Fair point.
You know, as Trump has indicated, this is how he negotiates. That, you know, when you look at how he does things, people often say, well, how could he do this? You know, Chinese President Xi, he's an enemy, he's a friend, he's an enemy, he's a friend. And, you know, people were suggesting that Trump is inconsistent in this. Well, that's, and Trump even said this is how I negotiate. He kind of keeps people off kilter to a certain extent, gets them out of their comfort zone. And that gives him, from his perspective, an advantage in terms of negotiating. Plus, and we don't often see it this way, but there are problems in China as well. Its economy is having troubles as well. So they're not just sort of weathering the storm that easily in terms of dealing with the tariff situation. They've got problems of one sort or another, not even to mention what's going on in Hong Kong at the time right now. And so it's a matter of being able to sort of stay on track from Trump's perspective, even though in terms of the things that he says, it kind of seems like it's one way one day, one another way another day. And as I said, people just aren't used to that type of negotiating, even though as I was thinking about this morning, we're, you know, almost 3 years into Trump's presidency and people still seem to be unnerved by this.
Tim, Republican Ron Johnson, U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, and his fellow U.S. Senator Democrat Chris Murphy say their visas were denied when they were going to go as part of a congressional delegation to Russia. What's your take on that situation?
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting that it's a bipartisan kind of situation, but both of those senators were fairly critical of the Kremlin. And as we saw recently with Israel not wanting a couple of representatives to come over, that countries have that ability, and we may not like it. We may think that it's appropriate. And I know some of the pushback with regard to Senator Johnson and Senator Johnson Murphy was that, well, hey, these are people that are, you know, government's representatives, and they have the ability to discuss problems that are in Russia. Well, from Russia's perspective, they say, well, look, this is not our problem. And, you know, if you're critical of our government, we don't want you here. Well, okay, we may not like what Russia's doing, but that's their prerogative. But it's also not entirely unusual that the United States and Russia often say that certain people are persona non grata and won't let them come into the country. Maybe it's not always high government officials like U.S. senators, but certainly there are a number of people that either we or they don't want in their in our countries.
And we just have a moment left, but is it different based on the person versus how, you know, the U.S. overall is dealing with Russia? Is Senator Johnson out of step?
No, I don't think so. He may be a little bit more forceful in terms of his condemnations of what Russia is doing, but it's certainly something that we've seen many other members of Congress do, too. Why they pick on him particularly, it's not entirely clear, but it's certainly gotten attention that if you're going to say, okay, we're not going to allow this person in, well, if it's a low-level diplomat, that's not going to get as much attention to what Russia is trying to do as if it's a United States senator
right.
or a couple of them.
Thank you. Tim, thanks so much for your time this morning.
You're welcome.
Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He's also a faculty advisor to the college Republicans there. Coming up, Wisconsin lawmakers approved sweeping changes to landlord and tenant protection since 2011, often tipping the scale in favor of property owners. What questions do you have about the rules for renters and property owners in our state? 800-642-1234. I'm Keeley Boltina, and it's The Morning Show. Since 2011, Wisconsin has changed laws governing landlords and tenants more than 100 ways. That's according to an investigation by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It turns out some of the lawmakers pushing for changes to benefit landlords are landlords themselves. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Are you a landlord or a renter? What do you think about lawmakers weakening tenant protections? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're talking about it with Mary Spicuzza. She's an investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me on.
We appreciate your time. Let's start with some of those laws passed since 2011, your investigation reviewed. How have lawmakers effectively weakened tenant rights when dealing with personal property after people are evicted?
So Carrie Spivak and I, Carrie is really an expert on this issue, and we just went through and reviewed. There have been some major omnibus laws that wrap in like a bunch of changes, and some of them, for example, allowed a landlord to dispose of tenants' property, or most of it, not prescription drugs or medical equipment, but most of it immediately after an eviction. Previously, they had to store it supposedly at renter's expense, and they disputed that and felt like it was too expensive for landlords. There have been some cases, however, of Carrie interviewed a woman for a separate story who said that, you know, she was basically going to try to get a moving van and came back and found her property, you know, all over the curb and had already been picked through by other people. So that's one of the changes. Another one is just speeding up the eviction process overall to try to make it easier to evict a tenant if they suspect criminal activity or believe criminal activity is occurring. However, it doesn't require a police involvement or an arrest. And so I think that tenants' rights advocates or tenants are concerned that that could be, you know, somebody thinks they smell pot and or marijuana and want to evict somebody. Landlords have disputed that and said it would have to be more serious.
And so speeding up the eviction process when it comes to criminal activity, also some defenses by lawyers who represent low-income tenants. What does change there?
So that was a change involving, well, really what a lot of lawyers who work with tenants felt like was targeting the Eviction Defense Project, which has been a project aimed at trying to curb evictions in cities like Milwaukee, where there's really, a lot of people read the book about it, but that a lot of people feel like it's a crisis where families are moving constantly and being evicted by landlords repeatedly. So this was a way that a lot of the time they're trying to have lawyers represent these tenants. And a lot of tenants, you know, just don't, they're not lawyers. They don't know their legal rights. They don't know different arguments that they could have in court. And so advocates really felt like some of the changes were targeting the Eviction Defense Project or similar groups
you
that
also
try to go to court.
Right. You also find that lawmakers have limited when tenants can withhold rent for living in poor conditions. How did Wisconsin law change there?
So that basically said that a tenant can withhold rent still if they say a unit is uninhabitable. But the new law says that they must directly impact health and safety. And as you can imagine, a landlord and a tenant may have very different ideas of what a problem that impacts health and safety would be. So somebody would say, my power keeps going out, it's uninhabitable because my food is spoiling and I can't see in the, it's dark. A landlord may feel like, well, we're getting it fixed and it's not going out that often, so it's not really a health and safety issue.
One law bans landlords from requiring proof from tenants for emotional support animals. So this is an example of lawmakers expanding tenant protections. How often did you find that?
Well, so that's actually it's interesting because they kind of actually tightened that rule a little bit. They felt like too many people were having emotional support animals and saying, like, this is my emotional support dog or my emotional support snake. So basically they said, we can't ban emotional support animals altogether, but we can try to get a doctor's note. So it's not just somebody self-diagnosing is that they need a emotional support animal where one is not typically allowed, especially if it's like a dog that other tenants might be frightened of.
Let's go to the phones now. John from Wazika. Good morning, John.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you. What question do you have?
My question relates to the livability of a rental property. I'm wondering what landlords are required to provide as far as, minimal standards in terms of having screens on the window, not having a leaky roof, and those sorts of things. I'm currently behind on my rent, but my trailer's not in the greatest shape. Roof in the bathroom leaks, have no screens on the window, currently don't have any electricity because they like you to pay the bill on time, and I haven't been able to do that. I'm traveling back and forth with Wazika across 5 days a week for radiation therapy for cancer, and I have a few more things that I can really manage on my own, but I'm trying to do it on my own.
Yeah. John,
It's really foremost in my mind this morning.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that experience. Mary, John's trying to figure all of this out on his own, and he's trying to figure out, what rights he has and what he should expect from his landlords. Does Wisconsin law say explicitly what livability means?
I'm so sorry that you're going through that. I think that it does sound like the leaky roof and the screens off the windows are a concern. I know that landlords, for example, are supposed to have a window that can open in each room. I believe that window is supposed to have a screen. I would have to double check, but it's considered, if somebody has windows that, for example, don't open, it's considered a safety risk, especially, if you think of trying to escape a building during a fire, that you want to have outlets or ways to get out of a room. So I think that, and then there are some also, I believe that there are some assistance programs for renters who are having, for example, like a medical emergency where you may be able to get assistance for your rent. So I'd be happy to, I think that there are some, I don't know if the Eviction Defense Project would be able to help based on where you are, but you might want to reach out to them or a tenant group in your area, because they do have lawyers who consult with people for no fee and can share their expertise. Since I'm not actually a lawyer or a tenant lawyer, I couldn't advise you, but I think that you really should reach out to somebody and look up the tenant resource group in your area.
We'll also
feel free to email me later and I can send you some contacts.
Great, great. We'll also make sure that those resources are posted on WPR.org. Mary Spacuzza is an investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm Keely Boltina, and we want to hear from you about lawmakers who are also landlords and changes for renters. Are you a landlord who's seen renters take advantage of you and legally do it? Maybe you're a renter like John and you feel like you've been treated unfairly. What's your story? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Mary, some people want statewide standards. Other people want local authorities to decide what's best in their communities. How have lawmakers limited local control when it comes to housing?
So this has been a big area of dispute between Republican state lawmakers who have been changing the laws, and cities like Milwaukee, Madison, Appleton, other municipalities too. But for example, state lawmakers voided local ordinances that mandated sprinklers in buildings if they have fewer than 20 units. So there was actually some clashes between lawmakers and firefighters or firefighter associations who were concerned about what they saw as weakening of fire safety standards. They also restricted how and when a local government can conduct neighborhood inspections. So Milwaukee's argument was that they were seeing a lot of violations and, among absentee landlords in places like the East Side, where there are a lot of university students, or the North Side, where there are a lot of renters and absentee landlords. And they really wanted to target certain areas that they knew were problems. The state lawmakers, Speaker Voss and others, felt like that was being implemented unfairly, and that certain landlords or certain neighborhoods were being targeted. So they really restricted those neighborhood inspections to the point where some municipalities have just stopped doing targeted inspections altogether, or really scaled them back because they felt like it was so hard to go out and do them that it was almost impossible to pay somebody to be able to get into a property if they weren't actually going to be able to, for example, get into the property. So those are just a couple of the changes that have kind of pitted the local governments that wanted to do some of these inspections that say, you know, we're the ones who know what's going on in our communities and we should be the ones setting the rules. But state lawmakers were concerned, especially complained about some of the laws in Madison.
Could property owners, including some lawmakers, benefit financially from those changes to local control?
So that's what we really wanted to. We wanted to get at the idea that we're not saying all tenants are good or all landlords are bad. We wanted to look at that area where, going through financial interest statements or statements of economic interest among lawmakers, I don't think Carrie or I realized just how many lawmakers are landlords. And some of them are not major landlords. They might own, just a couple of properties or a rental unit here and there. But somebody like Speaker Robin Voss from Rochester, he actually owns a number of properties in Whitewater, where he had gone to school, and is a fairly major landlord there. We counted, sometimes you'll sell a property here and there, but he owned close to $4 million worth of property, residential rental properties just in Whitewater alone.
And Mary, let's pause right there, and we'll talk about Speaker Voss when we come back. Mary Spicuzza is an investigative journalist, our guide through this conversation about lawmakers who are also landlords. Do you work in local government on housing issues? Should powers be expanded? Are they okay? 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Wisconsin's legislature has passed laws that benefit landlords, dozens of them in the last decade, and you can join our conversation about it. 800-642-1234. Tell us your story or ask what question you have. Also, the investigation shows about one out of every five state lawmakers who voted on the bills owned or managed rentals. What do you think about that? Mary Spicuzza is an investigative journalist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's taking us through their findings. Mary, we were talking about Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, obviously as Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly. He's an influential gatekeeper in the legislative process. You say he owns 23 properties worth almost $4 million in Whitewater.
Right. He does. He was a student there. It used to be called Ladwig and Voss was the rental company that was actually created by There was another family, the Ladwigs, the Vosses. Robin has taken it over. And this, I believe it's now called Whitewater College Rentals, although he has a couple of different companies there.
And you reached out to some of his past tenants, visited several of the properties. What did you learn?
You know, a lot of them, Carrie and I spent quite a while just walking around, looking at the properties. A lot of tenants were moving in and out because it was the end of the school year. You know, a lot of them looked like, I guess, your typical college rentals. You know, and I think some of them are probably have had some wear and tear from the tenants themselves. You know, there were some beer cups around and things like that. But we did notice, we talked to some tenants who had had issues. One of them actually sued him in court with her roommates, Candace, her last name is now Berryman, and actually they ended up settling, and she did pretty well in that lawsuit. And she said she had some pretty harsh words about Speaker Voss as a landlord. But other tenants we spoke to were more moderate and said, you know, he's a pretty typical college landlord. It's not like our forever home. There were some issues in one house that we visited. His office insisted that they were fixing those. And it had some, you know, standing water in the basement or pulled up water on the basement on the floor, some mold issues. His office said that that had work was planned and delayed and that they were going to fix it. But I would say probably the harshest critic we talked to was Ms. Berryman, who sued him in court back when she was a student and actually did quite well in that lawsuit.
What does Voss say about sponsoring and voting for legislation that could potentially affect his business? Does he see a problem?
He does not. He was very insistent that he is not looking out for personal profit, that this is all about what he sees as a property owner's rights. And that said, it's very in line with conservative values that he stands up for the rights of the property owners. Obviously, critics disagreed, and we spoke to an ethicist from the Bush administration who said that basically he sees it's very obvious that they're trying to help their own financial interests rather than the people of the state. And that I think his quote was, this is the kind of thing that makes the legislature look bad. So I think it's one of those where it depends who you ask whether they see it's a conflict of interest. But Speaker Voss, former Senator Lissay, who we also spoke to for the story, clearly did not.
Mary Spacuzza is an investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about the fact that some Wisconsin lawmakers own property and they vote on bills that sometimes lessen the rights for renters. Let's go to John in Milwaukee. John, welcome to the morning show. What's your question?
Hi. I wanted to find out if there's any length of time that landlords or even other people could try to exclude someone from a unit. You know, let's say that someone was thought to be a little disruptive or what have you, was evicted and moved out, but then returned later as a visitor. Can the landlord try to keep him from ever visiting again?
John, thanks for the question. Mary, is that within your purview?
That's a little different than the laws that we were looking at. However, it does. I think that it's one of those where there could be, depending on how disruptive they were or whether they committed a crime at the property, there could be a potential restraining order there involving another tenant if they were, you know, if they were a domestic abuser who was beating someone in the property and trying to return, that could be a legal issue that police or the courts may want to get involved in. But I would have to, it probably depends on the case and how when you say disruptive. So I don't
right.
think I could speak to that specifically, but it does. I think that there would be some concerns if somebody had been injuring somebody at a property and then trying to return.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The state has conflict of interest laws that are meant to stop people from using government positions for personal gain. Could these votes favoring landlords be a violation of that?
Well, so what they Speaker Ross did provide letters that he had gotten from the state about that issue. And basically the determination was that these laws were not specifically written to benefit Speaker Ross, and that it was a broader class of people than just him. So I think it would be more of a problem if or a more of a direct conflict or direct violation if, for example, a lawmaker said, I'm going to make it harder for local officials who regulate college rentals in Whitewater, Wisconsin, but because it was broader and didn't just specifically affect one lawmaker or two, that's why it was found to be not a violation.
What about this history of lawmakers in Wisconsin having other jobs, the so-called citizen legislators? How is a landlord dealing with real estate legislation different than someone like a doctor dealing with healthcare policy?
You know, and that was something that Speaker Voss and others brought up, is we are a citizen legislature. We're not full-time lawmakers, and everyone has, or most people have, I don't want to call them side gigs, but because they're probably pretty profitable businesses. I think what we noticed was that we haven't seen a wave of a bunch of doctors in the legislature passing bills that would benefit doctors. But we would certainly write about that if we did, not if they were, you know, if it was saying like making it, for example, harder to sue doctors. So I think that there are lots of potential conflicts of interest for all different kinds of professions. And this was just one that jumped out at us. Carrie's been covering a lot of landlord-tenant issues in recent years. I've been covering the state legislature for about 6 years, and it was something that both of us noticed was just there are a lot of laws that have passed that critics say benefit landlords and a lot of landlords of the legislature. So
today is a different political landscape than when these measures were passed, before there was a Republican state legislature, both chambers, and a Republican governor. And now Wisconsin has divided government. Do you see any changes to the tenant or landlord protections that we have now?
I think a lot of these changes would have a much harder time getting past Governor Tony Evers, who's a Democrat, than they did against I think it was a much easier passage for Governor Walker. That's not to say there might not be some areas of commonality that they agree laws should be changed. But I think even some of the lobbyists who work for landlords or landlord associations said that they felt like there was an opportunity to get laws passed because of who was in the legislature and the total control that Republicans had of, you know, both houses and the governor's office. So I would not be surprised if we don't see these sweeping, multifaceted landlord bills. I think that they would be a lot harder to get passed, and or they could pass and then be vetoed.
Timing makes a difference.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Mary. We really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Mary Spaguzza is an investigative journalist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've been talking about how Wisconsin lawmakers have approved changes to landlord and tenant protections. And some of those lawmakers who've supported the bills, they're also property owners or own different rental homes. She was talking with us about her investigation. You're listening to The Morning Show. Host Kate Archer-Kent is back on Monday. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network.